Sponsorship of this KQED podcast is provided by San Francisco State University's graduate business programs offering 5 accredited advanced degrees, the SF State MBA, rigorous, real-world, respected, open house schedule, and more information at mba.sfsu.edu.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org, and URS Corporation, a global engineering and construction firm headquartered in San Francisco, providing engineering, construction, and technical services to public agencies and private companies. URSCorp.com.
This is the California Report. I'm Scott Schaefer. Coming up, a pattern of abuse, an investigation into the treatment of vulnerable patients with developmental disabilities.
It's really a closed world that doesn't get the light of day, even from local law enforcement.
Also, nothing says excess quite like the 80s hard rock band Van Halen. Now, almost 30 years after their peak, the Bad Boys from Pasadena are making a comeback. And on this Oscar weekend, how to deliver a memorable Academy Awards speech.
If they just thought about it for a few minutes while they were getting their nails done, while they were getting their hair dried, they would probably do a much better job. Because ultimately, you want a speech that's short, sincere, and eloquent.
It's the California Report. Well, this week was the last chance state lawmakers had to introduce new bills before the Friday deadline hit, and they sure took advantage of it, pitching an avalanche of new bills onto the pile of pending legislation. Sacramento Bureau Chief John Myers is here to walk through some of the highlights. And John, why don't you start off by giving us a sense of just how many new bills were introduced under the wire?
You know, Scott, even as we're speaking here at the end of the week, you know, the bill's coming across the desk very fast. And so, you know, getting a full assessment is going to probably take even a couple of days. But by my count, as we hear at the end of the week, the last 6 weeks have seen about 300 brand new pieces of legislation here at the state capitol in Sacramento. Now, to that, you have to add several hundred more that were introduced in 2011 and are on, I guess I would call it, the final 9 holes of the legislative process. In a typical year in recent times, we have seen, or a typical session, it's a 2-year session, we've seen close to 2,000 bills that can make their way through the process. A little less than half of those usually make it to the desk of the governor, but a lot of stuff, you're right, a lot of really complicated proposals that the legislature is going to be looking at, and it is an election year.
Which of these bills, John, do you think could become sort of fodder during the campaign?
I certainly think that when you look at campaign issues and issues that the electorate's going to be talking about this fall would be bills related to the economy and public employee pensions. Now, there are several proposals whose either Democratic or Republican authors say will promote job growth, from ideas on worker training to fewer business regulations. But I think the pension issue and the clamor to modify those guaranteed pensions of state and local workers is really going to be a big one. You know, this week we actually saw movement on the pension reform ideas from Governor Jerry Brown. It's a plan that would have future state workers and government local workers, they'd have to work longer for a less generous benefit. Now, his plan has been languishing in Sacramento, and this week, unusually, it was introduced as legislation by Republicans in the State House. Here's Senate Republican Leader Bob Huff.
We stand here in a bipartisan way to come in agreement and say it's time to help get this underfunded pension system, which is hundreds of billions of dollars underfunded over the next 20 years, in line, and we have the language to do it.
And you know, it was an interesting move, Scott. These are Republicans, again, introducing a Democratic governor's pension plan into legislation. The Democrats here in the State House don't really like that plan right now because it's got this proposal for a hybrid pension 401k system for future government workers. They've still been negotiating with Jerry Brown, and now the Republicans have said, hey, let's run it up as legislation.
Let me ask you another question, John. You know, California has a knack for bills that make national headlines. The shark fin soup ban comes to mind. As you look through the bills that have been introduced in the past several weeks, are there any of those in the hopper you think that could end up on the cable talk shows?
I think there are. I mean, a couple that have really gotten some prominence here in the last couple of weeks. One of them would ban food trucks. You know, they're very popular all across California. These food trucks would be banned from being within 1,500 feet of a school. And the author says this is, a Democratic author says this is to keep school kids from coming out and eating at those trucks. But, you know, if you look at the maps of some California cities, there are so many schools, the food trucks would be effectively banned everywhere. There's also was a bill from a Democrat, Democrat State Assembly member Das Williams of Santa Barbara this week, to ban electrolyte drinks like Gatorade from schools.
And, John, you know, last year when Jerry Brown vetoed a bunch of legislation, he said, you know, not every problem needs a government solution. Do you see any legislation pending that the governor, you know, potentially could look at in that same way?
I think so. I mean, I think we've talked about a couple of them here. I mean, you're right. He seemed to have a disdain for legislating everything. I also think keep a close eye, too, on what Democratic priorities are, especially some things that from the more liberal factions of the Democratic Party, even organized labor. And if those bills come to the governor's desk, the governor trying to court the business community about a tax initiative, this is a complicated series of political decisions that I think the governor will have to make when he signs or vetoes bills.
John Myers, Sacramento Bureau Chief. John, thanks so much. Have a great weekend.
You're welcome.
Some of the most severely disabled people in California are cared for at state-run facilities called developmental centers. The state spends about $300,000 a year on each of the 1,800 patients living at those centers. But an 8-month investigation with our media partner California Watch has uncovered a pattern of abuse and a failure to hold staff accountable. Michael Montgomery reports on the death of one patient and his brother's effort to uncover the truth.
For 42 years, Van Ingram lived in a Spartan room at Fairview Developmental Center in Costa Mesa, one of five centers for the disabled around the state. As a child, Ingram couldn't form words and was diagnosed with severe autism and other disabilities. As he grew, he was constantly in motion and difficult to control. So his older brother, Larry, says his parents turned to Fairview for help.
They saw that it was a safe environment for him, that he was going to be safe and taken care of.
Ingram says Van seemed happy at Fairview, but there were unexplained injuries, broken bones, a black eye, abrasions. Ingram says he was concerned, but had trust in the institution.
I honestly believed that it was just natural occurrences, accidents.
But one day in 2007, Larry Ingram got a call from Fairview. A supervisor left a message saying Van had been taken to the hospital.
We're not sure what exactly is wrong with him right now.
The phone message led me to believe that Van had some little incidental injury that was minor, and that was it.
But when Ingram got to the hospital, Van was in the emergency room. A neurosurgeon told him his brother had a broken neck and a crushed spinal cord.
And he told me adamantly that he felt that this was done to Van, that it was not an accident.
Van Ingram died 6 days later. As a retired police officer, Larry blames himself for missing what he now suspects were earlier signs of abuse.
I should have known that something was going on. I should have known the signs were there, and I was a cop, you know. I was his brother, and my job was to make sure that everything's okay, and in my mind now, I feel guilty.
Three outside medical experts raised alarms about the way Van Ingram died. One said his broken neck was likely a homicide, but staff at Fairview maintained his injuries were caused by a fall from his bed. 5 years after his brother's death, Larry Ingram is at home digging through a pile of documents, photographs, and medical reports. Ingram never accepted what officials at Fairview told him.
Third picture back.
So he decided to do his own investigation, together with his friend Donovan Jacobs, another ex-cop who's also a lawyer.
For one of those facility people to write that somebody severely breaks his neck by slipping out of bed is just ludicrous.
Documents from the case paint a picture of a bungled investigation by Fairview's in-house police. They waited 5 days to interview witnesses and failed to collect blood samples and fingerprints from Van Ingram's room. And that wasn't all.
Straight across.
Ingram and Jacobs are looking at a copy of an internal logbook documenting what Van Ingram was doing at the time of the injury. It shows that Van's caregiver changed the logbook entry to indicate the patient was resting and awake and not sleeping. On the page, an R has been penciled over with an S. To Jacobs, this might be evidence of a cover-up.
What we later found out was they made that change 2 hours after Larry asked that that log be preserved and not changed.
Fairview's in-house police never investigated the changes to the log. this wasn't the only time officers working for the state developmental centers failed to conduct a thorough investigation. In our reporting, we found hundreds of cases of patient abuse and unexplained injuries that were documented at the centers and then dropped without arrests or prosecutions.
It's really a closed world that doesn't get the light of day, even from local law enforcement.
Former California Assembly member Sally Lieber authored a 2008 bill that would have required outside law enforcement agencies to handle criminal investigations at the developmental centers. She says her goal was greater accountability for patient abuse, but the legislation never passed. To Lieber, rising abuse rates and few prosecutions indicate little has changed at the centers.
Have they ever been held accountable? And I think the answer is no.
I think our job is first and foremost to protect the individuals that live in our developmental centers.
Terry Delgadillo directs the Department of Developmental Services, which runs Fairview and the state's four other centers. Delgadillo declined to discuss specific cases, citing privacy laws. But she says when it comes to patient abuse, her department enforces a zero-tolerance policy.
When something goes wrong, we take very, very aggressive action. If we identify that somebody's been involved in abuse, we terminate them.
Department officials told us 67 employees had been dismissed in client-related actions since 2008, though they couldn't say how many were connected to patient abuse. They also couldn't say how many center employees have been arrested or prosecuted. For years, Larry Ingram staged protests at Fairview on the anniversary of his brother's death. Now, he's gone to the justice system.
Hello. How are you doing today, sir?
Recently, Ingram and Donovan Jacobs planted themselves in front of the district attorney's office on a busy street in downtown Santa Ana. They carried hand-drawn pickets and were passing out flyers.
Our goal is to get the district attorney in gear and get him to take some action on my brother's homicide.
After about an hour, a district attorney investigator named Eric Ackerman emerged from the building to talk.
Very disappointed in how the system has dropped the ball on this.
Well, sorry for the loss of your brother.
Okay, sir. Well, thank you very much, sir.
I'll pass this up. So.
Ackerman didn't commit to anything, but he said he'd look into the case.
I appreciate you taking the
interview. Okay, if you have any...
Ingram has already won an $800,000 civil settlement from the state, money he says he hasn't spent.
The only reason we got this far is because... Dom is an ex-cop. I'm an ex-cop.
Hey, Donovan, do you have any more flyers? I'm running out.
Ingram says he believes most of the staff at Fairview and at other developmental centers work hard and are devoted to patients. But he says investigating his brother's death showed that when something goes wrong, there's no effective system of accountability, not for his brother and, he fears, not for other patients.
That's when I decided that I'll never stop. I'm going to go after him as long as I can and as hard as I can until justice is done.
Ingram is still trying to convince authorities to open a criminal investigation into his brother's death. For the California Report, I'm Michael Montgomery.
That story was produced in collaboration with California Watch. It's a project of the Center for Investigative Reporting. The team included Ryan Gabrielson and Monica Lamb. You'll find the details on their special investigation on our website, californiareport.org. Bands like Kiss, AC/DC, and Aerosmith would be on any short list of the best hard rock groups of the 20th century, but few epitomize 80s excess like Pasadena-based Van Halen. This month, Van Halen put out its first album with original vocalist David Lee Roth in almost 30 years. Much of it's based on unreleased songs the band debuted at backyard parties and seedy clubs, even a bar at the Pasadena Hilton in 1975. That's where KPCC's Stephen Cuevas picks up the story.
Oh, yeah. Van Halen at the Hilton. I don't know. The two go together. Whoa. It even sent out the flyer, no blue jeans, man. How about that?
Van Halen had just formed a couple years earlier, primarily as a cover band, but it was already starting to perform its own songs at backyard beer bashes across the Pasadena area.
What do you do on a Friday or Saturday night? Oh, there's a party. You go for the chicks. Maybe get some beers, you know?
Doug Anderson spent a lot of time in some of those backyards.
And the band, well, sometimes they're too loud. That's where Van Headache came from.
All right, bye.
Anderson runs the unofficial Van Halen Museum from his vintage amplifier shop near Altadena. It includes some of Eddie Van Halen's old guitars, a wall of concert flyers, and piles of unreleased live and studio recordings from the mid-70s.
Something to hear, you know, it's funny to hear. This is Gazzari, 74. Who knows what's all on here? They really played as much as they could anywhere and everywhere. You know, in those days, they really worked hard. It wasn't an easy gig. And they started writing more songs, you know, and then started just really getting good at it. There's a lot of groups around that were great, and they just happened to make it, you know.
For its first album with vocalist David Lee Roth since the Reagan administration, Van Halen taps that reservoir of material accumulated in the years before its explosive 1978 breakthrough. Some get new arrangements and lyrics, others barely stray from their garage rock origins. Here's Van Halen playing the song Bullethead at a Pasadena show in 1976, followed by the version that appears on its new album, A Different Kind of Truth.
They were highly developed as a band by that time.
Ian Christie is the author of Everybody Wants Some, the Van Halen Saga.
I think it's a common practice among probably all artists that your workshop is filled with pieces and just something's not right about a certain Pinocchio or whatever you have sitting around. And then all of a sudden, you know, one day Geppetto pulls out the right carving tool and notches out an eyebrow, and all of a sudden that's Pinocchio.
Another resurrected number called Out of Space is based on a tune that originally appeared on a 1976 demo tape produced by Gene Simmons of Kiss.
All right, well, we were playing one night and some of the fellas from Kiss came down to see the band who you brought along.
Shortly after cutting that demo, singer David Lee Roth was interviewed on LA rock station K-Rock by local music impresario Rodney Bigenheimer, who dragged Simmons to see the band in Hollywood.
A couple days later, we were in New York City doing a little tape recording down Electric Ladyland Studios. So what we have here is one hell of a demo tape, and this is the first radio play we've ever gotten. It's just a tape here, but we're proud to be on the rocks of Los Angeles.
What's it called?
This is called Running with the Devil.
Van Halen biographer Ian Christie says dipping into a reserve of older material became common practice for the band early on. As Van Halen's popularity soared, so did demand for more shows and more new material. The unreleased old stuff became new stuff and helped the band keep pace.
All of those first six David Lee Roth albums are considered classics, and they released one of those per year between 1978 and 1984 while playing like 250 massive arena concerts a year.
Rolling Stone magazine says Van Halen's new album, half of which is based on those old demos, is its best in 28 years. Others have been less kind, including the operator of the Van Halen Museum, Doug Anderson.
They should have brought it out back a long time ago when they were really good.
But writer Ian Christie says plugging into those old songs may have helped the band recapture an energy that many critics say has been lacking for years.
The chemistry that they put together in the 1970s wasn't just going to naturally pick up again. To go back in and pick up all of the nuances and prompts from those cassettes, it must have worked some kind of mystical, historic mojo on the band.
Wanted out west to the California coast, where the folks who know about frostiness stay frostiest the most. My brand new
Van Halen hits the road this week for its first U.S. arena tour since 2007. The band plays shows across California this summer. No backyard keg parties are currently scheduled. For the California Report, I'm Stephen Cuevas.
But tie up your cowboy. Stay frosty.
Sunday night, millions of people will tune in to the Academy Awards, hoping to see a memorable Oscar moment.
The first time I didn't feel it, but this time I feel it, and I can't deny the fact that you like me right now. You like me.
That 1985 Best Actress acceptance speech from Sally Field was memorable, all right, but, says LA-based communications coach Leandra Caney, not always for the right reasons.
People like it because, again, it was very spontaneous. It was very from the heart. It was also humble, and that's one of the key things you need to see in an Oscar speech. You need to see humility. But later on, people thought it was a little maybe too girlish, and it was so easy to mock.
Caney has some Hollywood clients, and she admits the stars don't always shine on Oscar night.
If they just thought about it for a few minutes while they were getting their nails done, while they were getting their hair dried, they would probably do a much better job. Because ultimately, you want a speech that's short, sincere, and eloquent. Those are the three things you want. If you can be funny, all the better.
Caney says there's lots of reasons potential Oscar winners don't plan ahead, like they don't want to jinx it.
So a lot of people are superstitious about preparing. Some people feel it's presumptuous and they don't want to appear arrogant. They don't want the audience to think that they actually thought they might win. And if you pull out a sheath of notes, then you know people might think, oh, well, they expected to win.
Everyone seems to have their favorite and least favorite Oscar moments. A common theme, though, says Leandra Caney, is spontaneity.
One of the examples that people seem to like very much is when Matt Damon and Ben Affleck won for Best Screenplay for Good Will Hunting. And they were just all over the board, jumping up and down and yelling and shouts out to Boston.
John Gordon from Miramax.
John Gordon. Chris Moore produced
the
movie. And,
Chris Moore.
Patrick Weitzel, the best agent in Hollywood.
Yeah, and, Patrick Weitzel.
And Cuba Gooding for showing us how to give our acceptance speech. And,
and all our friends and family. And everybody back in Boston.
Winning an Oscar is the ultimate dream of anyone who goes to film school, right? Well, screenwriter Steve Bowman hasn't taken home a golden statuette, not yet anyway, but in his early 40s, after a career in journalism and a stint with an organ transplant center in Chicago, Bowman enrolled in the legendary film school at the University of Southern California. And before he even graduated, he'd sold a television series to CBS. He's written about it in a new book titled Film School, a memoir that will change your life. Steve Bowman, welcome.
Hi, thanks.
So tell me, why film school? What made you at the age of late 30s, early 40s, decide you wanted to make kind of a career turn like that?
I'd been a newspaper reporter and then a freelancer, and I had been writing scripts on the side for several years and spending hundreds of hours doing it. And my wife at the time was saying, well, you know, why don't you try to pursue it at a higher level? And we debated doing that, and I was a little bit reluctant. But then she got cancer, and we really had a come-to-Jesus meeting and thought, let's jump in here. I mean, it's we couldn't be much more desperate, but if not now, when?
And you know, relatively speaking, you're an old guy. You kind of stuck out, I imagine. How did the younger sort of hipster students regard you, and what did you think of them?
Well, there was no relatively old. I was old. I was the old guy. I was
the dinosaur.
I was always mistaken for the professor or maybe the coach. And you know, at first they treated me, and my reputation on campus was that old guy in an Oldsmobile 88. I couldn't have been more of a square. But as my time went on, that, I'd like to think, disappeared.
I don't want to cut to the end too quickly, but you drop out after the first year, in spite of the fact that you're doing really well. You go back to Minnesota, and after a while, you decide you're going to go back to California. You get back here, and shortly after arriving, you're not feeling well. You end up at UCLA Medical Center. You've had a small stroke. How did it change your perspective, either about film school or life, or your, you know, determination to get through the rest of the semesters you had at USC?
At the time, it was terrifying. There was no getting around it. It was a frightening and scary time. But the thing was, is I had already quit once, and I was not going to quit again. So I kept going, and I'm really glad I did. I had plenty of people saying it was a foolish idea, but my wife was supportive. She didn't want to see me retreat and then live life sort of licking my wounds and saying, oh, I coulda, shoulda, woulda.
Did you, when you were in film school, did you think, like so many aspiring screenwriters do in Los Angeles, that you were going to hit it big? I mean, you, as I said in the introduction, you did end up selling a series to CBS. But is that, I mean, how surprised were you by that?
It was one of those very, very pleasant surprises in life where, and I had been working on many different fronts, on many different ideas and writing scripts. And the thing that eventually sold was one that was a fairly small project that I was working on. So the irony of ironies is was that, you know, this was 5% of my time in film school was the one that sort of blew up.
And the circumstances where you were taking a pitch class, trying to sell ideas for shows or movies, and you decide to pitch a TV show that's based on a transplant unit of a hospital in Chicago. How did you come up with that?
Because I had worked at the University of Chicago as a liver transplant coordinator as a 25-year-old. And I spent a year traveling around the United States and setting up surgical removals and sometimes assisting in the surgeries. And it was a crazy time. And I knew it was a crazy story. And it gave me access to a world that very few people have access to.
So you make the pitch for this TV idea. And happenstance is such that one of the people on the panel giving you feedback is the former head of the drama unit at Fox Television.
Yes.
And he's really taken by this, and they decide, in fact, to make a pilot out of it at CBS. What are the odds of that happening, do you think? I mean, how many pitches do people like that guy get in a year, and how many of them actually end up turning into a pilot, much less a series?
My instructors at USC repeatedly came up and would put their hand on my shoulder and say, Steve, you have to understand this never happens. Pilot was shot while I was still in school. And, you know, I got my diploma on Friday afternoon. And on Saturday night, I get the call from the insides that we're going to staff up.
They shoot 13 episodes. It's called Three Rivers is the name of the drama, and it's no longer on the air. But, you know, looking back on it, what do you make of that whole experience?
You know, I would have certainly liked to have had a larger impact on the show and certainly would have liked to have seen the show go on longer. But to be honest, I was thrilled when we went to pilot. I mean, that was my dream come true. And then to have it go on the air as a series – that sort of was beyond the ability of my brain to compute it.
It's Steve Bowman. His book is called Film School, a memoir that will change your life. Thanks for sharing it with us.
Hey, no problem.
And that is The California Report, a production of KQED Public Radio. Our director is Susie Racho. Seal Mahler is our technical producer, with additional engineering by Howard Gelman. The senior online editor is Gabriel Cohen, with help from David Marks. Our interns are Andres Barraza and Liz Reed. Pat Flynn was a contributing editor. Our senior producer this week is Victoria Maleone. The producer is Polly Stryker. The executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the James Irvine Foundation, celebrating the 2012 recipients of the James Irvine Foundation Leadership Award. More information is available at www.irvine.org. And the California Endowment, building healthy communities because that's where health happens. More information at calendow.org.